Thank you very much for letting us know and for ensuring that that important part of the agenda is addressed. So thank you very much, Honorable Mohammed. So we have the following apologies. Honorable Nebo Drechens. Any other apology from other parties? Nine. Well, thank you. So should we proceed to start with Ms. Embrace Dignity? Is this Mr. or Ms.?
It's Ms.
Ms. Yeah. Sorry, my apologies. So, ma'am, you have 15 minutes to make your presentation. Now it's 10 past 9. 20 past 9, if you should be back.
Thank you very much. Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Justice and Correctional Services and members of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. My name is Advocate Phumla Duane-Altman, the Executive Director Designate for Embrace Dignity. I'm accompanied here by my colleague, Mr. Tom, who has come here to also assist in answering questions. There's an assumption that the submissions have been read, so I will not take much of your time. But basically, to thank the Portfolio Committee for giving us the chance to make our oral submission. The main concern is with respect to sections 12.4a(i). And our submission is that the said section of the bill may have unintended consequences, especially for victims and or survivors of prostitution, in terms of the wording of the section itself, because it encompasses that word, any sexual offense, in terms of the common law, which implies that it would include persons who have committed an offense or have fallen within the ambit of section, of section 21, capital AA of the Sexual Offences Act 23 of 1957 as amended. So basically, our argument has been that, and has always been, that sellers of sex are not there by choice and that they should not be prosecuted. Submissions were made to that effect. The South African Law Reform Commission has also made a recommendation to the effect that buyers, sellers of sex should be arrested and prosecuted, but that they should be allowed to be diverted in order to enter the exit system. Our view is that in this instance, in light of that, the state would have, especially with regard to this bill, the right to institute a civil claim as an aggrieved party, and thus it would then extend its focus on women who've already exited the prostitution system, as well as those who are in it and want to exit the system. So rather, the focus should not be on them, but on the demand itself, the buyers, the pimps, and the brothel owners, as well as property owners who actually encourage this. Secondly, with respect to the second part, sections 12.4a(2), although we acknowledge that certain offences within the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act are included in the prescription bill, however, there are some omissions with respect to that, and it's submitted that conduct facilitating or promoting trafficking in persons, as contained in section 6.8.1, and the disclosure of information pertaining to the said person, exposing the third person to danger and or compromising the investigation in terms of section 23 must also be included in the prescription bill. And we are submitting that because it's in light of the seriousness of the offence that the Trafficking in Persons Act actually portrays and therefore should be included and not be excluded. Those are our submissions.
Are you done? Okay. straight to the point. Honorable members, we have our own 15 minutes, 25 past. Any questions and comments to the presentation as presented by Embrace Dignity? I take it it's well understood. Can to the next presentation. Second. Thank you very much. Thank you for attending and contributing to the public hearings and to enhancement of this amendment of the Act. Commission for Gender Equality.
Thank you. Good morning to you, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. And I also greet the members of this Portfolio Committee. My name is Tamara Matebula. I'm the Chairperson of the Commission for Gender Equality. I'm accompanied by my colleague, Ms. Marisa Samikek, who is a Senior Legal Officer within the Commission. The Commission welcomes the opportunity to make an input into the beneficiary selection and land allocation policies. And I think as an independent statutory body, we have the power to evaluate any acts of Parliament and make recommendations to Parliament on any legislation with regard to any law affecting gender equality or the status of women, or make recommendations to Parliament to adopt a new legislation which will promote gender equality. So I would hand over to my colleague, Ms. Fanny Kex, to actually just go through the areas where we make submissions. And I know that we have submitted in advance and we take that our report was read. Thank you, and over to you, Marisa.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Honorable Chair of the Committee and Honorable Members. We will just touch base on our submission to say that CG celebrates the progressive judgment of Lewis Stein versus State Franklin. It has made a significant impact for all survivors of sexual violence, especially women and children. CG is of the view that amendment to legislation should be more victim-centered, and that is what Section 18 amendment will specifically do. The CG fully supports the proposed amendment of Section 18, as worded in Clause 3 of the bill, USA to the order of the Constitutional Court. We note that in terms of the order of the Constitutional Court, Parliament effectively has until 13 June 2020, and CGE takes the opportunity to offer its support to the Portfolio Committee. We stand ready to assist the committee in any way that is necessary to meet the deadline. With regards to the Declaration of Invalidity, which is retrospective to 27 April 1994, CG is of the opinion that it does not mean that victims before 27 April 1994 do not benefit from the order. We believe that that would be an incorrect interpretation based on the principle of legality that is confirmed in Section 35 of the Constitution. In terms of the CGE sees an opportunity in terms of amendment of civil law prescription as well. We believe that the bill presents a valuable opportunity to remove another barrier to access justice for survivors of sexual violence and abuse, and especially adult survivors and childhood sexual abuse. The CG submits that the proposed amendments to the Prescription Act as per the bill do not go far enough in its development in law. Terms like intellectual disability, incapacity, and disorder have already have specific interpretations in our law, and where they do not, the survivors will obviously have to wait for courts to interpret them. It is widely acknowledged that the extent of gender-based violence and femicide in South Africa has reached a crisis proportion. The civil law of prescription have already been developed in matters such as Van Zyl versus Wuchenhuis, and that was also confirmed in both of judgments in the Constitutional Court, where it was stated that prescription is in effect there to penalize inaction of people.
recognize the barriers that there are in reporting. And in fact, from CGE's perspective, these barriers in reporting means that victims cannot report the crime or institute civil action, and the penalization is that of the victims. It's not necessarily the perpetrator. And you know, as we go along, you will see why I'm saying what I'm saying. In light of the court's recent, the court's reasoning in Levenstein, we submit that it's time to remove prescription from South African law insofar as it applies to death arising from sexual offences. CGE submits that the same emotional and psychological trauma that prevents victims, the vast majority of rural women and children, from reporting sexual offences in the criminal justice system will logically follow also in the civil courts. In terms of the statutory 3-year period, the same barriers apply to them as well. The Constitutional Court held in the Levenstein judgment that the evidence before the court revealed that countless of women and it reveals what countless women and children face. It illuminates the system, systemic failures that enable violence and exploitation of them to occur. Specifically at paragraph 56, the court held that of importance is that the systemic sexual exploitation of women and children depends on secrecy, fear, and shame. Too often survivors are stifled by fear of their abusers and their possible responses from their communities and from our perspective also families, because these people are in a position of authority and power over them. In paragraph 53 of the judgment, the court accepts that the 20-year prescription period previously imposed by Section 18 is insufficiently cognizant of the nature and process of sexual assault disclosure. The court in the judgment also accepted that personal circumstances of the survivors may change. It comes with the with maturity, it comes with the ability to process if they needed psychological counselling, for example, and then would be able to face reporting. We believe that this this principle is no less the same in civil litigation as it is in criminal reporting. And therefore, we feel that there shouldn't be a limitation of the right in terms of prescription for civil claims. Then, in terms of broadening access to justice for survivors, the court found that the reluctance of many victims, specifically in relation to the statistical small eventuality of a conviction in a criminal court, is one of the barriers why criminal prosecution does not happen or the criminal reporting does not happen. These same barriers actually apply to civil law as well. For this reason, it's imperative to remove the barriers to alternative avenues for justice for survivors outside of the criminal justice system. Such alternative avenues include the civil courts where special damages might be claimed, for example, medical and psychological treatment or loss of earnings. It is acknowledged that the criminal justice system inherently presents obstacles and barriers for survivors, and it follows that all possible alternatives must be accessible as well. In August 2018, Women of South Africa rose up in a countrywide protest to demand change, resulting in the presidential summit against gender-based violence and femicide. The declaration that emanates from the summit, and specifically in Article 5, stipulated that existing laws and policies applicable to gender-based violence and femicide will be reviewed to ensure that they are more victim-centered and responsive, and that the identified legislative gaps should be addressed without delay. Based on the above, CGE is of the opinion that in the first instance we do support the amendment of Section 18, but secondly we would also request that prescription in terms of civil law also be relaxed, so that civil deaths arising from sexual offences may be claimed other than just a 3-year prescription period. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, CGE. Honourable members, any questions or comments? Thank you very much, Commission for Gender Equality, for your input. We will now go to Lawyers for Human Rights. have up to 20 to 10 to make a presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good morning, honourable members and guests of the committee. Thank you very much for inviting us to make this oral presentation to you today on the basis of our written submission. For those of you who are not familiar with Lawyers for Human Rights, we are an independent human rights organisation with a 40-year track record of human rights activism and public interest litigation in South Africa. My name is Sanya Bornman, and I manage the Gender Equality Programme at Lawyers for Human Rights, and the Gender Equality primarily pursues systemic remedies for gender-based violence and discrimination in South Africa and in the region. And I'm lucky enough to have with me today, sitting next to me, Advocate Anel Bitoy, who represented us in our role as Friends of the Court when the Levenstein matter was heard in the High Court, and again as respondents when the Levenstein matter was being heard in the Constitutional Court. And she will be assisting me today to explain some of the criminal law aspects of our submission and why we argue the way we do. So on the issue of criminal law prescription, without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Advocate Toy to give you a bit of an insight into why we argue what we argue in our written submission.
Good morning, everyone. Just before I forget, just to address something about the submission made by Grace Dignity earlier. During the Levenstein matter, the question was asked specifically by Justice Cameron whether the lifting of prescription could not be used as an instrument against previous groups specifically, such as gay men, for example, because of the common law crime element. And the court did consider that and yet kept the order as it was. So it was something which was considered whether this, and the argument that was given in court was specifically that there are enough levers in the NPA system and enough protections for that, for the wording to be as wide as it is. Now, with regards to criminal cases, historical sexual offences, as I say, there are certain barriers in the criminal justice system, which means that very few cases would actually make it to court. The first barrier is legality. So if you look at the Frankel facts, these offences allegedly took place between 1970 and 1989. Now, the way in which the principle of legality operates is that though Mr. Frankel, in terms of this new legislation, could now be prosecuted, he can only be prosecuted in terms of the law as it stood at the time. So if, for example, his actions did not fall within the new definition of rape, he cannot be charged with rape now. He can only be charged with sexual assault. And, moreover, the sexual assault, the punishment, will not be in terms of, for example, minimum sentencing legislation, because that wasn't in place. So that is the type of factor that the prosecution will consider when deciding whether to actually go forward with a case. Now, Section 179 of the Constitution says the discretion to prosecute remains in the hands of the NPA. Prosecutorial directives say the NPA must prosecute if there is sufficient evidence so that there's a reasonable prospect of success and also conviction. So in many cases, the NPA, in exercising that discretion, will say there simply isn't enough evidence to pass that standard. And that is why it's so important that when Sanya discussed the civil remedies, that we do not limit unnecessarily the access to justice within the civil remedy, but civil realm. Now, the other limit to prosecution is the second element is what is in the interest of justice. Now, if a prosecution should follow, if I'm the defense counsel for someone who's charged with a crime that was committed in 1978, the first thing that I'm going to do is do direct representations to the NPA and say why, A, there's not enough evidence, and B, the prosecution of this case will not be in the interest of justice. So again, there are certain very strong barriers to criminal prosecution that exist in our criminal justice system.
Thank you, Advocate Atoy. So, as Advocate Atoy has now explained, LHR fully supports the proposed amendment as set out in the bill, clause 3 of the bill, to bring the Criminal Procedure Act in line with the judgment and the order in the Levenstein matter. But we do need to keep these limitations in mind when we begin to talk about the civil law of prescription and what the bill proposes to do there. So ordinarily, civil claims prescribe within a period of 3 years. This is familiar to all of us. And the prescription period begins to run when the survivor, in this instance, because we are speaking now of survivors of all sexual offences, either the survivor turns 18, in other words, attains the age of majority, or the survivor becomes aware that a debt is in fact due. So the amendments as they are currently set out in the bill will mean that any particular survivor who is approaching the civil court will have to prove in court that they were unable to institute proceedings because of a mental or intellectual disability, disorder, or incapacity, or they will have to prove that they are a person under curatorship or are prevented by superior force, including any law or any order of court from interrupting the running of that 3-year prescription. So that means if the survivor then approaches a court more than 3 years after the offence and they cannot prove any of these exceptions, their claim will have prescribed and they are effectively barred from accessing civil remedies. So why can LHR not support the proposed amendments in the bill to the civil law of prescription? And in this regard, we have a lot in common with the Commission for Gender Equality and their reasons for being unable to support the amendments as proposed. Firstly, survivors seeking justice through civil courts are equally affected by the emotional and psychological effects of sexual abuse as they were set out in the Levenstein judgment and as they have generally been accepted by both the High and Constitutional Courts. And there, in effect, is no difference in the effects of a sexual offence against a person who is seeking access to the criminal court versus the same person seeking access to a remedy in the civil court. Secondly, given the effects of sexual abuse, which again has now been expanded on and accepted by both the High and Constitutional Court, it would not be justifiable to distinguish between survivors on the one hand and survivors who have mental or intellectual disability, disorder, or incapacity on the other hand, because they all have justifiable reasons for delaying in taking that action and in seeking justice, whether it is in the civil court or in the criminal court. And a very, very important finding in the Levenstein judgment is this idea that there should be no hierarchy of sexual offences, right? So we need to take that into consideration, that hierarchy has now essentially been abolished and all sexual offences are equal in the sense that they all have these psychological and emotional consequences. Thirdly, the proposed amendments do not sufficiently remove barriers, in our view. In fact, they create potentially another barrier to entry for those survivors seeking access to civil courts, especially for the poorest and most marginalized of those survivors, because proving those exceptions that we spoke about in the previous slide is not easy, and it is also not cheap. These will necessarily require survivors to introduce expert evidence. They will need reports. They will require experts to come and testify. And we can tell you from our experience that that kind of expert evidence is very expensive to obtain. And it's even more difficult to obtain that kind of expert evidence on a pro bono basis. So this creates a significant barrier. And again, as the CGE has said, secondly, terms such as mental illness or incapacity already have very specific and limited, in our view, meanings in existing law. And as the CGE has also argued, this means that those terms are now necessarily limited, or the courts will have to interpret them over time. And that means that many survivors might feel that they are not willing to take a chance, and they will perhaps wait even longer to see how courts might interpret those terms over time. And that is not the removal of a barrier. We argue that that introduces further barriers, in fact. Then lastly,
what do you have in substitution of that?
Chair, thank you, Chair. We are going to propose what we suggest instead in the very next slide. The last reason why we feel we cannot support these amendments is exactly the same as the CGE has argued. We feel that at this point in South Africa, there's a very clear commitment on the part of our government to review laws, to strengthen mechanisms, and to open up avenues for all survivors in both the civil and criminal spheres. And so we really do believe that it is the appropriate time now to make even laws that are civil in nature, such as the Prescription Act, more victim-centered. And we think that for this reason, we submit that it is in the interest of justice and the constitutional rights of all survivors of sexual offences to entirely scrap civil law of prescription and the prescription of all debts and claims that might arise from the alleged commission of any sexual offence. This is supported, we believe, by the recent jurisprudence that relates to prescription, not only in the Levenstein matter and in relation to criminal law, but also several recent judgments that relate to civil law prescription, and it is also appropriate and necessary in the light of South Africa's commitment to expanding those avenues for justice for all survivors. And Advocate Du Toit is going to respond in terms of what we propose instead for a wording. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, just before I do that, just the unintended consequences of the wording as it stands now. It reminds me of a criminal law where capacity after, you might remember the famous hockey stick case, that was with ED. And what happened is that the court said you need certain expert evidence to come to court with that defense of non-pathological criminal incapacity. And what happened within a year or two is that it became the rich man's defense, because the expert testimony required can only be afforded by a certain part of our society. There was a famous case, I think, Lopes, with a woman who killed her husband. She couldn't give expert evidence, and she went off to jail while other people succeeded. And that is the unintended consequence when you create an onus which requires money. Yeah. And then finally, as Tue's wording, I think it says, as it stands, there simply can be an exception with regard to sexual offences. Again, it's not that all sexual offences will now be prosecuted even in civil courts, because there are certain steps again. There are still many, many barriers to that. It's not as if we're going to have an onslaught on our courts in these cases, because what we're saying is that to have on the one hand this huge barrier lifted in criminal law, and on the other hand put a 3-year limit on most victims in sexual offence cases is irrational.
Thank you very much, Chair. That's the end of our presentation, and we welcome your questions and comments.
Thank you very much. You used exactly 15 minutes. Thank you for taking your time. Honourable members, questions, comments? Honourable Hisham Mohammed, Honourable Gwynis Bredenbach. These are the two questions. Honourable Mohammed.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. Just 2 points. The word incapacity, would you... I know you said limited to the limited connotation if you take other judgments into account, the past. But if the regulations or other forms of this, the Act defines that more pertinently for the purpose of this particular related to that, just not in your presentation, but I'm just thinking, would an unlimited or no prescription in civil law affect any form of quantum for damages, taking case law into account, particularly 394 and Liberis and other judgments?
If you have thought about that, and one recognizes the point about the earlier point in the previous presentation that what would constitute in public interest often would depend on the prosecution being the decision maker whether to prosecute or not. As we say, terminus litis there are, but in it often dependent on the test, as you know, is what is it beyond reasonable doubt. And in these matters, referring now to the criminal ones, would often mean real evidence of what is it, medical, if there's medical, psychological reports. Taking that criminal perspective into account, would that have an effect the non-prosecution? So claim if it's open-ended, meaning there's no limitation to keeping into account that ratio that you've just given because of there's often delays, but you didn't say you said unlimited. Do you think if there's a prescriptor then it is now 3 years, obviously let's go out and say we agree with you fully that 3 years is not. What would you, if they were to be a limitation, what would that be? Thanks.
Honourable President.
Thank you, Chair. You talk about barriers to prosecutions for sexual offence-related matters, but the barriers that you talk about are there for all prosecutions, really. And they're there for RILA. So that, you know, notionally people don't get prosecuted for fun. And so, you know, I hear you and I don't disagree with the essence of your presentation, but I don't for one moment agree that you can remove those barriers. I think they're necessary and important, and they're there to protect everybody from gratuitous prosecution. So, you know, I understand that there are hoops that victims of sexual offences must jump through. But they're not significantly different to the things that anybody else must jump to. And in that sense, you know, I don't mean to be insensitive or controversial, they're no different to any other victim of crime. There's a standard to be met in criminal prosecutions and you can't lower it. But when you do that, when you move that line, we all know where that goes. Does the prosecution policy really say that the standard is sufficient, credible, admissible evidence for a successful prosecution which equals a conviction? I mean, does it? I don't think so. I may be wrong, it's a while since I've read them, but certainly in my own experience as a prosecutor, which is not inconsiderable, my view has always been, and I'm sure that Bronwyn will agree with me, a successful prosecution is where the guilty people are convicted and innocent people are acquitted. And that is a successful prosecution. A conviction, above all else, has never been a standard to check. In fact, anything but. So I'm sure that the prosecution policy doesn't say that. And if it does, then that's something we'd have to have a look at. You say onuses that require money are problematic. I can see where you come from with that, but what do you do? Expert evidence has become a bit like father's forensic evidence. It's essential. It costs money. Someone has to pay for it. Pro bono doesn't pay the bills. You can prevail on people to do bits and bobs for free, but you can't ask people to work for free constantly. It's just not how life works. So what is your suggestion there? How do we overcome that problem? you can't expect a court to make a finding of a complex psychological nature without proper expert evidence. So who's going to pay for this? Somebody will have to. I also actually don't agree with your submission that prosecutors consider the principle of legality when deciding whether or not to prosecute in the sense that you suggested they do. So I have never in my entire prosecution career considered the fact that I would have to prosecute under an act that is older, a sentence that is lighter, as a reason to not prosecute. You just prosecute within the boundaries that are there. In my experience, prosecutors are generally quite keen to prosecute sexual offenders, as long as there's sufficient evidence to mount a credible prosecution, and bearing in mind all the other factors that you take into account. One of those is the traumatic impact on the victim. And, you know, the younger the victim, the more the trauma. And those are things you consider. Is the game worth the candle at the end? Is it worth putting somebody through all that? And it's not a decision that you take one morning in the shower. You know, you consult widely, you consult with victims, you consult with experts. It's a big decision because you understand what's at play. And I'm sure that most prosecutors do it that way. And specifically, the prosecutors who specialize in this kind of thing certainly consider those issues. I'm 100% sure of it. So when the prosecutor decides to not prosecute, I don't think it's for frivolous reasons. I think it's because they've taken everything into account, and at the end of it, the game does not seem worth the candle for one reason or another. But it would be a good reason. And then I have the same issue that Mr. Mohammed raised. If we remove barriers to civil change, will that not just create, and again, forgive me, I don't mean to sound insensitive, but not all cases that are reported as sexual offences are really sexual offences. People do cry wolf. There is such a thing as no, 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 yes. And in my own experience, there have been matters that have been reported as rape that in fact were not, and had a more of a financial slant to it than a sexual offence. Will it not open floodgates for those kinds of spurious, and I'm not suggesting that there are hundreds and thousands of them, but it would be an encouragement to people who are so inclined, and there are such people, to try and abuse that particular system. Thank you.
Within the civil context as opposed to criminal context and so on. The the directives, as Brasenbach definitely says, that it's the new FBA directives, it says where there's a reasonable prospect of a successful prosecution and eventual conviction. That are, those are the exact words.
Could you please say that?
I will. And then the barriers, I think I might have expressed myself incorrectly. It is exactly, and I'm a defense counsel, so I'm all for the barriers. I think what we argued in the Constitutional Court is we don't need prescription because we have these barriers in criminal law that must be there because we also have fair trial rights. We have rights of the accused. And I, in fact, went a bit further and said I don't think we need prescription at all for any serious crimes because there are these barriers.
Maybe just to add on to what Advocate Tatum has already said, I think that the question of expanding on the issue of incapacity and so on in the regulations, it certainly is an idea, but it might well not go far enough. And at the end of the day, still requires some interpretation by the court, which might be different in different fora, and will necessarily take some time. And given the urgency with which sexual offences and remedies for sexual offences are currently being approached by the legislature, the executive, we're not entirely sure that strategy would be in keeping with that sense of urgency.
There was also the question as to quantum, whether a non-prescription period may influence quantum. I think that this would be a question of fact in every case, because this would again be a situation where a court has to assess damage. One might say is then that we require expert evidence in any way, but not necessarily, because we see in Fonsalvo, this is working out, an acceptance by our courts of the societal damage of sexual offences. A person does not need to come and bring a doctor and say this was... There is a general acceptance, and what we will see over the coming years is jurisprudence. In intellectual damage cases, there's a book called Koch, and what it does is it has lists of damages. And what we don't see at the moment is sexual offences. So within the next 10 years, well, there are, but very few. So what we will see over the next 10 years is a list of comparable cases, and those the courts use to come to a decision as to what is a reasonable quantum in this specific situation.
Chair, I'm just checking whether we have answered the question satisfactorily.
Yes, you have. The department is also listening, so they will be responding to all these issues, the issues you have raised, as we will be deliberating next week. Thank you very much. Thank you for making inputs into this process. I think we will have a better piece of legislation after this round of inputs. Thank you very much. Can we go for Women's Legal Center?
Good morning, my name is Brian Tippy. I'm a lawyer from the Women's Legal Center. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Honourable Chair and all the members, colleagues. We have made a written submission, and I will attempt to take the committee through the most pertinent aspects of that written submission within my limited time. Just briefly, the Legal Center is an African feminist legal center which advocates for the rights of women predominantly through strategic litigation but also through advocacy, law reform, direct legal services. I'd like to address three main areas of our submission. The first being the issue of retrospectivity. These are the concerns that we have around retrospectivity, both in relation to the criminal prescription and civil prescription sections. And then I will address the committee on the issue limitations that currently exist for civil claims in sexual offences. We welcome the latest version of the bill, which has lifted the criminal prescription and effectively civil prescription of all sexual offences, whereas previously it was limited to certain types of sexual offences. So we are very enthused by the change of the latest version of the bill, and we support the latest version of the bill in that sense. Also, just to say that as with Lawyers for Human Rights, Women's Legal Centre was involved in the Levenstein matter at both the High Court and the Constitutional Court stage, and was very obviously invested in the declaration of invalidity of Section 18. And we also welcome the department's proactive actions in addressing the issue of civil prescription before that matter went to litigation. In terms of retrospectivity, I'd like to start off by saying maybe quite an unusual thing is that I wish that we were wrong about our interpretation of the current section, in that ideally the interpretation of the current section to mean that the lift to the bar of prosecution in all sexual offences would be indeterminate, in other words it goes back indefinitely. I would welcome that interpretation and open to be persuaded, but unfortunately I suspect that we may be correct in the sense that retrospectivity is actually limited. Well, the effect of the bill as it now stands means that there is still going to be a limit on the prosecution, and by implication it will also have effect on the civil prescription pieces of legislation. There are three pieces of legislation that actually apply to civil prescription effectively over the last, well, basically from 1943. So, I mean, there probably aren't that many people alive still, but theoretically it does actually exist. So if we look at retrospectivity, I'm going to state some of the basics that the right to prosecution, to interfere prosecution, obviously vests with the NPA. And before the challenge of Section 18, that right was limited to 20 years for certain sexual offences. And when I say certain sexual offences, we're talking about the ones other than the obvious one of rape, and then there were a number of other others that were listed. So the default position of retrospectivity is very clear, that the Constitutional Court has said that when something is declared unconstitutional, it is invalid from the date of the enactment or the date of the final constitution. What the Constitutional Court did in Levenstein is it actually gave us a few extra years and said this piece of legislation comes into effect when the interim constitution was passed. In other words, on the 27th of April 1994. It becomes very important. So it's normally would have been in 1996, but it's gone back to 1994, and that's an exception. So that is why we believe the Constitutional Court made that provision. If they had been silent, its previous judgments would have held, and it would have held as the final constitution, which is in February, sorry, 1997, I apologize, in February 1997. Okay. So what that means is that as of the 27th of April 1994, Section 18 becomes invalid. So the NPA is not restricted from 20-year bar for prosecuting any offences that occurred 20 years before that. In other words, it can prosecute any sexual offence from the 27th of April 1994, 20 years back, in other words, to the 27th of April 1974. On the 26th of April 1994, Section 18 was still in effect because it's not unconstitutional. Can I go backwards? So in other words, 20 years back from the 26th of April 1994, with everything before the 26th of April 1974 cannot be prosecuted in terms of the 20-year bar. And that is our concern. I understand it's very technical, and I understand there are lots of dates being thrown around. But that is our concern, that at the moment that we're looking at cases, and we're not talking about rape. Rape has no limitation. Let's just clarify that. But and a sexual offence which was not a rape at the time, pre-1974, would not be able to be prosecuted by the NPA in 2020 or 2021 or whenever it is, because of the law as it stood at the time. And this is not about the principle of legality. With respect, I think that's a red herring. That's not about the principle of legality. The principle of legality is about what the law is at the time in terms of the nature of the offence that you can prosecute. In the Levenstein matter, those incidents that occurred at the time were not sexual assault, they were indecent assault. They would have to be prosecuted under indecent assault, they would have to be prosecuted under rape or sexual assault, because those are the new pieces of legislation since 2006. But the law as it stands, for example, some of the offences that were actually committed in the Levenstein matter, for what it's worth, were committed in 1970. Those matters, in our opinion at the moment, once the law changes in terms of this bill, would actually not be able to be prosecuted by the NPA. Now, we think that there is a way to change, we think that there is a way to accommodate that, and that is those are the submissions that we've made, that we think that it would be constitutional for the legislature to specifically revive the rights of the prosecution to prosecute matters pre-1974 of this nature. We think that it would be possible, and it would be, we request that the committee looks at that and maybe ask the department to look more closely at that to see whether that would be a possibility. The reason we say this is that it raises this weird anomaly again of a differentiation between types of victims and types of offences. So if you were indecently assaulted in 1973, the NPA would not be able to prosecute that matter. But if you were indecently assaulted in 1975 or 1974, the NPA would. And that's, of course, taking into consideration, and I'm just rehashing exactly what everyone else has said, the numbers of barriers and all the other things that one would have to consider in terms of a decision to prosecute. We always have to take into consideration, let's just have the door open for the NPA to consider whether to prosecute the matter. It doesn't mean they have to prosecute the matter, and that's very important to make that distinction as well. So that's the issue around criminal prescription. I'm not going to go into much detail around civil prescription, except that it has the same effect if we don't have retrospective clauses in legislation, because the current 12.4, as it now stands, in terms of the psychological, the exception that exists for sexual offences, only came into operation in 2006. So there are previous, the previous section, which is 12.3, would govern sexual offences matters pre-2006, and the previous act would also cover cases pre-1969, which is when the latest piece of the latest civil prescription legislation came into effect. Okay, so if I could just address the civil prescription briefly. The current 12.4 has the exception of 3 years, but for sexual offences, if there is proof that the complainant or the applicant, or sorry, the plaintiff, it would be in this case, I apologise, the creditor is unable to institute proceedings because of his or her mental or psychological condition. So this is based on the principle that prescription does not run against he or she who is unable to act. And that's important because the law recognises that for sexual offences or particular matters where there may be reasons why a creditor, a survivor, a victim is unable to act because of his or her psychological or mental condition. So So the new bill has changed the wording, and I'm not going to address myself to the new bill, because as with the previous colleagues who have submitted, we are also of the opinion that it is time for the legislature to look very carefully at lifting the limits in totality to civil prescription. So we're in agreement with the Commission, and we're in agreement with Lawyers for Human Rights. We're not aware of if anyone else has made submissions, but if they would, we would obviously be in support of that. Again, I won't go into detail. It's in our submission around what the court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, has said in the Fonsale matter, where there's been a recognition that there are peculiar circumstances around sexual offences that have to be considered, and that the Fonsale matter gave direct rise to the new clause in 12.4 that was passed in 2006. It's important to note that the Constitutional Court has recognised that prescription as in and of itself is a limitation on our constitutional rights. Our constitutional rights are ensured in Section 34 to say that we have access to justice. We have a fundamental right of access to justice. Prescription fundamentally undermines that right. It basically says that if you don't do something within 3 years, in most circumstances, we will preclude you from going to court. And the court has been very clear to say that it has to be justified. It has to be justified in terms of the limitations clause. So while there has been an acknowledgement on the part of the court that the government has a legitimate purpose to bring prescription in, the actual Prescription Act has never been directly challenged constitutionally. And we believe that the Prescription Act, particularly in terms of sexual offences, is ripe for challenge. You'll see from our submission that we believe that there are a number of justification reasons why we don't believe that the limitation on the right to approach a civil court is justified. A lot of that jurisprudence is, as colleagues have already pointed out, based on what the Constitutional Court has said in Levenstein, and we encourage you to look at those that reading. And we would say that really the class of persons in relation to sexual offences is so peculiar and so different to other matters that it really needs to be reconsidered. I'm running out of time, so really suffice to say that because we don't, there is an evidential onus, it's not a burden of proof, but it's an evidentiary onus that rests on a plaintiff in a sexual offences matter to show that at the moment they have psychological or mental condition to explain why they haven't come forward. That is both a legal and emotional burden that a plaintiff would have to carry in order to do that, and realistically it obviously does involve experts, etc. So at the moment, what we would suggest is that, and we've backed that on the last page of our submission, that Section 12 could be amended to reflect that prescription should not commence to run in respect of a death based on the commission of a sexual offence at all. And there are some comparative jurisdictions who have done similar things, so we wouldn't be totally unique, but maybe just to say that that really is something worth working towards. For what it's worth, the Women's Legal Centre is currently looking at a matter where we are going to challenge the civil prescription on constitutionality issues. So I would encourage the portfolio committee to maybe be in advance of that potential litigation, so we can avoid that, and we to consider the possibility of lifting civil prescription. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Women's Legal Centre. Are there any questions or comments from honourable members? None, I think it's clear. Thank you very much for the presentations. Can we now go to the Congress of South African Trade Unions? You have 15 minutes.
Thank you very much, Jay. Good morning, colleagues, and good morning, comrades. I start by making an apology for my colleague, Matthew Fox, who has made this submission on our behalf, Chair, and with your permission, I'll take you forward. Under the introduction, Basato welcomes and supports the prescription in civil and criminal matters amendment bill. The bill is progressive and seeks to enhance the protection of victims of sexual offences and must thus be supported. Basato urges Parliament to ensure the speedy passage of this bill. Whilst Basato supports the bill and its enactment, we believe that there are several critical and unconstitutional and other flaws that must be addressed as a matter of urgency before the bill can be passed. If these flaws are not addressed, it will serve only to leave thousands of victims of sexual offence behind and open to abuse. On the matter related to the delays in passing legislation, the Federation is alarmed over the unreasonable length of time it has taken Parliament to process the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill. Judgment was passed under the Constitutional Court on the 14th of June 2018. Parliament was given 24 months to make the necessary legislative amendments by the Constitutional Court. We are now 3 months short of that deadline. In short, Parliament will fail to meet the two-year deadline set by the Constitutional Court. It is simply unacceptable, Chair, for government and Parliament to once again fail to abide by very generous time frames set by the Constitutional Court to correct constitutionally invalid and discriminatory legislation. There are no acceptable excuses for this lack of urgency by Parliament and government. This is not only once-off occurrence, but in fact a frequent problem on the part of the legislature and the executive that must be addressed. The public cannot be expected to take Parliament seriously if its members fail to perform the role granted to them by the Constitution, as well as to fulfill specific requests by the Constitutional Court. The continuous failures by the executive to table legislation and by the legislation often pass legislation timelessly has a detrimental impact on workers and the poor in general. When the executive fails to lead, the Parliament is fully empowered by the Constitution to draft and adopt the necessary legislation. Authority is not a virtue. Basato supports the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill. Basato welcomes and strongly supports the bill. The objectives of the bill are progressive. The bill seeks to correct the constitutionally unfair and unacceptable consequences of the 20-year prescription of prosecution for any sexual offences in terms of common law or statute. Basato supports this bill as it will now eliminate this unfair and serious form of discrimination and in effect will remove a get-out-of-jail-free card for rapists and other sexual offenders. This is a critical weapon in the struggle to protect survivors of sexual offences. Under point 4, Basato proposed amendments to the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill. This bill provides for the commencement of the prescription for cases from 27th of April 1994. In other words, the date when the Indian Constitution came into effect. However, the effect of imposing this date is a form of prescription in itself. It allows for prescription for sexual offences that occurred before 27th of April 1974. This in itself is unconstitutional, discriminatory, form of victimization. There is a provision in law for retrospective legislation. The removal of prescription in 2020 sexual offences from the 27th of April 1974 is confirmation of this. There is no constitutional provision required in such a limitation. If a retrospective removal of 20-year prescription from before 27th of April 1994 can be affected in 2020, then any such prescription for sexual and other offences provided for in the bill can and must be removed. Basato's proposal. In short, the date of 27th of April 1994 must be removed, and the bill be amended to remove any form of prescription from sexual and other offences referred to in the bill. 4.2, the bail for sexual offences. The level of sexual violence in South Africa is at the horrific level. Few perpetrators are charged, prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned. Most perpetrators are known by the survivor. Some of the key reasons that survivors do not make charges or see through the prosecution of their cases is that the accused are usually granted bail or granted in a short space of time and are subject to intimidation by the accused with little protection from the state. Survivors need to be ensured that they will be protected from being a victim a second time. The Cossack proposal is that effective that the bill be further strengthened by providing for the automatic denial of bail to persons accused of sexual offences in certain instances. under 4.2, Kutwala cases. The kidnapping of women and often minors in the name of Kutwala remains a serious problem in certain parts of South Africa. The government has repeatedly committed itself to enacting legislation to avoid any cultural practices that results in the kidnapping of women and minors, their subsequent forced marriage and related sexual offences that may be committed. Our government has repeatedly failed to act upon this commitment. The South is proposing in this regard is that a bill or an amendment to the sexual offences bill be drafted to prohibit any cultural practices that result in the kidnapping of women and minors, their subsequent forced marriages and related sexual offences that may be committed, and that this be done as a matter of priority. In conclusion, Chair, Gustavo welcomes and supports the bill. The Federation urges the speedy passage of the bill by Parliament and its accession to the President. Gustavo urges Parliament to insert its proposed amendments by removing the 27th April 1994 limitation to prescription for sexual offences. The bill should further be amended to remove the option of bail for persons accused of sexual offences in certain defined circumstances. Legislation should be drafted to tackle serious offences committed under the Kutwala and other cultural practices. Finally, Kusato hopes that the submission and the proposals will assist the Portfolio Committee with its critical task in ensuring the speedy passage of the bill. The Federation trusts that these proposed amendments will be considered and acted upon. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Kusato. Honourable members, can I note hands for comments or questions? Honourable Mola, Honourable Breitenbach, Honourable Mohamed, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair. Apologies, of course, for the late arrival. I was seated there by M340. Hello, see ya. Chair, as it relates to the submission of the Federation, I hear the same tone and the same language. We were seated here last time we had public hearings. I'm not quite sure which legislation we're dealing with. COSATU slammed Parliament on the late attendance to Constitutional Court dates. On the orders. We took responsibility for that and affirmed our commitment to ensure that constitutional court rulings are attended to in the given time. But I hear the same tone and the same structure of paragraphs in the submission. And I am surprised because I am under the conviction that we have not yet reached the deadline for this legislation under review. I expect to be collected. If I'm making a mistake, I am of the view that we are still within our time to deal with this matter to its finality. We take here the issues raised, which I think they are consistent on the retrospective application of the bill, of the order and the bill, which I think it's a fair legal argument. Must be considered when we have deliberations around this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mola, Honourable President.
Thank you. I have a question about bail. So, in your submission, you suggest the bill should further be amended to remove the option of bail for persons accused of sexual offences. In your oral presentation, you added the rider in certain circumstances. What would those circumstances be in your view? And does Cassandra really hold the view that it's fair to just deny people bail on the basis of a certain charge, bearing in mind that not in every event, but certainly there are spurious charges laid of a sexual offence nature. Are those people to be denied bail? Is there not a general confusion in the general population with the nature of bail proceedings and the nature of criminal proceedings. So I'd like your view on that. The purpose of bail, of course, is to ensure attendance in court. It's not a punitive process. So what would be the motivation for refusing bail in a blanket fashion? How would that be justified in a constitutional democracy where the Bill of Rights holds the view that the right to freedom is paramount? I have difficulty with that submission, if you could help me with that.
Thank you. Honourable Hisham Mahomed.
Yeah, Chair. Almost basically covered by Honourable Wittenbach on the bail issue. Obviously, automatic would not be sustainable constitutionally. I'm sure you may want to think about that one. As we know, the proverb that people are innocent to prove guilty, but there are conditions in the court have to, we must take that into account in a special offender or other evidence even for first offender or alleged offender. I was also interested to, if you have a idea, but maybe you can submit it afterwards, what would be conditions in that aspect.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mahomet. I think those are the comments and questions from Honourable Members. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much for those questions, colleague. On the Constitutional Court and our ability to comply with the timeline set down by them, I think the only point we're trying to stress as COSATU is that we have to ensure that this August House focuses on making sure that bills and legislation are expeditiously passed. We hope that this will meet the deadline if it's not yet passed, but there's certainly our experience that means that we have many concerns about what has been delays on many areas of legislation, and we for consistency purposes raise it again here in respect of this one, Chair. But we take the appreciation of the points that were made. The difference between our written submission and the points made today in respect of certain circumstances for payroll is the point that we will happily come back to the House in. My colleague had put together the submission as is. I, in the discussions, had certainly reflected that you can't deny people payroll. There may be concerns about bail being granted too easily and some of the conditions attached to that. But Chair, with your permission, we'll make a further written submission in respect of the issues that we have amongst them. And that would either be to outline some of the concerns that we have or to then correct what may be the area of that submission that would not be keeping with the Constitution. Thank you.
Honourable Members, I think we have come to the end of the public hearings. The public hearings next week, the department would be responding to some of the issues that were raised, and we'll start with the deliberations. Our endeavour is that we want to pass all the three legislations by the time the House rises on the 18th of March. That is the endeavor to do that. So our program is quite tight. We'll be looking for the rest of next week and the week after. But we are sure that some of them, if not all of them, will be passed by the time they rise, so that the NCOP can start its own process. Thank you very much for coming to enhance the process. Public participation is an important constitutional requirement for us to be able to pass laws. So for you, for your organizations to take this opportunity, we are really happy, because we can only be as good as the laws that are passed by with the consent of our people. Thank you very much. Honourable Members, we are going to be dealing with the consideration of the draft reports on judges and magistrate salaries, the adoption of the draft committee reports on magistrates disciplinary reports. And we have 5 minutes break so that other guests can leave the chamber. I think before you, there is a draft, a report on the determination of salaries and allowance benefits payable to magistrates annually. Do you have that report, the draft report? And then you have also a draft, a report on allowances, benefits payable to constitutional court judges and judges annually. Do we have that report? We have for you, you have a report, a lengthy report. Okay. We have sort of a lengthy report on Magistrate I. Mayberg. Do we have that report? Do we also have a report, a draft portfolio committee report on Magistrate D. Naya? Do we have that report? Secretary, those are the only reports we have. Okay. Can I not read word for word on the report? Can I just move them? Do we agree? Can I move the report on Magistrate D. Naya, Chief Magistrate of Pretoria, tabled in terms of section 13, subsection 3B of the Magistrates Act 1993? At 90 of 1993, dated 6 March 2020. It's for provisional suspension of this magistrate, Chief Magistrate of Pretoria. Honorable Breitenbach?
Chair, I see that we have a quorum problem, and I just want to place on record that I know Mr. Naya very well. Yes, I know we do.
Okay.
But if I go, we don't have one.
Okay.
So I'm placing on record that I know Mr. Naya very well. I've worked with him for many years. His suspension or not doesn't depend only on me. There are enough of us. So I don't think that I'm conflicted. But I'm just placing it on record.
Same year, I worked with Mr. Naya, but I don't think I'm conflicted at all. The relation wasn't personal, it was largely working.
So can I propose, is there anyone who proposes the adoption of the report? Honorable Duncan. Seconded by Honorable Jenny. And the report of Chief Magistrate Naya is adopted. We have the report of Magistrate I. Mayberg, and I have a mover. Honorable Kohler, seconded by Honorable Breitenbach. Thank you very much. The report on the notice determining the rate with effect from 1st April 2019. Fixed salaries, allowances, and benefits are payable to constitutional court judges and judges annually, dated 6 March 2019. Do I have a mover that the judges will not be getting an increase? Honorable Mohammed, seconder. Honorable Mola. The reports of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services on draft notice determining the rate with effect from 1st April 2019, at which salaries, allowances, and benefits are payable to magistrates annually, dated 6 March 2020. I think it's a 2.8 and a 4.5% for magistrates, respectively. Do I have your number? Honorable Jale? Do I have a second? People who work in the justice department are just special for us. So, honourable members, we have passed, I think, all the reports. Am I correct? We have passed. We have dealt with the consideration of the draft report on judges and magistrate salaries that has been done. We have adopted a draft report on magistrate disciplinary reports that has been done. Is there anything that we have not done, Corporate Secretary? Okay. I am aware that the treaty is going to be dealt with on Tuesday, and there was a suggestion from Advocate Breitenbach that the chair was the treaty, there would be. Would you do declarations?
Why?
No, there would
what
be
do
not,
we have to say?
I think there's nothing to say. Take it outside. And then on the draft report, is there any likelihood of a declaration being called?
Okay. On the suspension, I think we just note that. Normally the House just notes that we don't.
Yeah.
No, we don't debate on those.
We're not doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Even on the salaries. Thank you very much, honourable members. Let me thank you. I think we're processing a lot of work compared to what we were processing last year. We are going to be depending on you, especially for next week, to try and ensure that the three bills are passed. If there are technical issues, my suggestion would be when we dealt with the access to information, we're able to deal with the technical issues even with Honorable Horn and Honorable Dennis Breitenbach. So I think we must isolate issues that we might disagree on, which are technical, and try and test those things out quickly. But let's try and have all the bills passed by the House, especially by the 18th. So which means not next week, week after next, it will just be bills from the justice side.
And
when
are we
going to
start
the family again? I think Honorable Kaula did very well. I think it did very well. My only challenge, that is why I kept quiet. A bill to be passed by Parliament, it must be passed by both houses, and accepted too by the President. And I think by 14 June, we would have passed the bill as the NA. I'm not sure about the NCOP. But it's this whole legacy issues we are dealing with. But I think after this one, I think after this one, we won't have challenges. The chairperson of the subcommittee, there is that bill, I think there are two bills under you. Honorable Janji? I think there are two bills under you that would need to be also fast tracked so that we ensure the department expedite those bills. I think there's another one that the deadline is May 2021. That we try to push them to so that at least by the end of the year that bill must be finished by both houses. But we will keep you informed. We will keep you informed of the developments. But we will try and ensure that the three bills are passed. Thank you very much, honourable members. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.